Good stuff there on Free Business Friday. You need to jump on this. There's no catch. It's free. You're a small local business safely open. You need to be a part of this. This has been a huge success, and we hope a lot of you continue. Just go to our website, thegamenashville.com, and learn how to be a part of this. We have talked every Monday, and it's been more than just on Mondays. We've talked a lot on this show about The Last Dance, the two episodes they're showing every Sunday night starting at 8 o'clock Central. And Kurt Bloom is on the line with us. He is the voice of the Birmingham Barons. Kurt, how you doing? Good afternoon.
Great. Darren, Willie, and Chase, did I get it all right?
You got did.
Good. Hey, mentally, physically, doing great. You guys are just talking about wearing masks, and people have seen me in public in Birmingham and in the Pelham area. They've recommended I should put on a mask for years. So that's nothing different for me. And you know, I just paint two eyes and a mouth, and then I go on and broadcast.
And you've been doing that for a long time. By the way, Pete Weber says hello, and I know he's going to be listening to this. And you guys are good
friends. The greatest. Yeah. The best. If I'm half the character in terms of being half the man he is, then I've had a pretty good day. I've never met anybody as generous and as wonderful. And your city, Music City, has an incredible ambassador for the game of hockey and for in just in general how to do things the right way.
No doubt. And Pete's background is also in baseball. He's a huge baseball fan as well. So let me just start with this, Kurt. I'm sure you've been watching The Last Dance. What have you thought through six episodes?
First thing is, it's been exciting because I'm watching it with my eldest daughter, who was born in 1994, the Jordan year. In fact, she was born in August. The other thing that comes to mind is, if we had baseball, I wouldn't have the time to be watching it because it would have been sometime in June, July. But I guess the way I sum it up, guys, is that the rest of the world now gets to see some of the angles and some of the vision that we had and some of the rapport and just basically a lot of the things that we knew inside that city and inside our locker room. That's what everybody's getting to see. His incredible work ethic, his incredible desire to win and to not lose. And then really we're getting to the key and obviously with baseball, but I just keep going back to that statement he has made on The Last Dance where he said, to Phil Jackson, he goes, Phil, and he put his hands above his head. He goes, mentally, I'm out of it. You know, I'm done. Physically, I might have a little bit left of men. But we saw that, and that's something that the city and the Barons locker room, everyone saw that he was exhausted mentally. And that was something now, you know, again, 26 years later, everyone is able to see this little secret that we kind of saw.
And so, Kurt, you've been the voice of the Barons since when?
Too long, way, way, way too long. As Charles Barkley said during that year, names, he said, you must not be that good. I got there in 92. 93, we won a Southern League championship. And then 94 is when Jordan came. And remember, guys, Nashville was in the league. So that was kind of that was a cool thing. I will personally buy the first Nashville guy lunch if they can tell me the nickname of the Southern League club that Nashville had back then. They both had AA and AAA, by the way.
Yeah, the Express.
The Express.
That's why I owe you lunch.
You owe Willie lunch. We've definitely
owe Willie lunch.
Talked about that in
now,
the past.
And I'll drive up and we'll head out to one of the drive through windows in the dollar menu and we'll take care of that.
There you go.
So what do you remember? I mean, so those are the early days you with the Barons. So what do you – take us back in that time and what that whole scene was like.
Well, the first thing is you have to remember that I was in total disbelief and total this is not going to happen. You know, that's where I start the story. It just was too incredulous to believe. And I said it this way, not only is he going to come on, you know, he is the world's greatest – basketball player ever, arguably the world's greatest athlete, but he's not going to get on a plane to Birmingham. And then in our case, it's really a suburb called Hoover. I said, this is not going to happen. And eventually it did. So I was just in total disbelief and total shock. And even the first couple of days, guys, I really thought someone would pull the plug, maybe Michael, and say, you know, that this is not for me, or I'm going back to basketball, or I'm going back to my family. It was something that for the at least the first couple of weeks, you didn't know if today was the last day. You know, you look in the lineup card the next day, and then no longer you see a Jordan in there, you know. But it was totally false. He played practically every game, and we spent 150 incredible days together.
So we've talked about, you know, Charles Barkley went on after episode 6 and went on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt, and he talked about in his lifetime the two biggest stars, sports stars that he's seen in his lifetime are Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods, just their whole persona, right? Not only what they did on their playing surface and in their sport and in their craft and how much success they had, but just what they were like at all, what their life was like at all, you know, at all times in that realm, in that world. It was just chaos. It was, you know, basically a traveling sideshow of everywhere. And we're starting to see that in The Last Dance, right? Like when he's sitting there on the couch in the hotel room and he's like, this is the best. You're sitting here, nobody's here. And the minute he walks out of that hotel room, it's chaos. Just going to the bus and there. So what was that like? Just the constant attention on Michael Jordan everywhere he went.
You said it perfectly. And I wasn't old enough to be around for the Beatles, but this must have been what it was like for them in the early mid-60s. And I will tell you this, I've made a statement now, and I knew it back then after a couple of weeks. The only thing that I would trade with Michael Jordan would be his bank account, because literally you can't go to a movie. You can't go to a different sporting event. You can't go shopping. And you pinned it exactly. And this is what, again, we saw. You hear about that, and there are icons in every sport, the Wayne Gretzky's of the world, the Joe Montana's and Tom Brady and all that. But to live this and see this every day was remarkable, and he literally could not make one step, move anywhere, do anything without somebody wanting something. And that is, like you said, you know, it does become stifling and suffocating. It was an incredible scene. He's on the couch, big cigar, glass of wine, chilling, and basically that's what his life. It's not like I can go, you know, when I travel with the Barons, we play the Chattanooga Lookouts and the Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. I can go down the street and go to the deli, and man, no one's yelling and screaming at me and said, hey, there's, you know. So, but that's what it was like. He could not, there's no normalcy. And I think that break from basketball to baseball, he was trying to seek a little normalcy, if that's possible. I know that sounds strange, but it's something that if you're not Tiger and you're not Muhammad and you're not Michael, I don't think, guys, we could be on the phone the next 4 hours. We can never explain what their lives are really, really like.
We're talking to Kurt Bloom, radio broadcaster for the Birmingham Barons, and he was at the mic the summer that Michael Jordan played baseball. So, Kurt, I actually was a minor league baseball player the summer that he was playing, and one of the discussions we had a lot, and I was with the Blue Jays, and I was not a Double A, so I was several levels below that. But one discussion we had in spring training a lot was, you know, Michael Jordan, we love him, etc., but on one hand, he is taking the place of somebody that would otherwise be getting the opportunity to play every day in the outfield for, as it turns out, the Barons. We didn't know what team he was going to be playing for at the time. But how was the camaraderie among the team while he was there? I actually caught some of that 30 for 30 that was specifically on, I think it's called Jordan Rides the Bus.
Right.
Just a fascinating depiction there. But you know that, you know, in a minor league locker room, that competition, that inner competition is there to start with. And then you throw on top the whole dynamic of Michael Jordan. That had to be an interesting mix.
Well, if you're jealous, you get no autograph and no picture with him, so you better throw that out.
Yeah.
But more importantly, you know, really, and you can listen to Tito Francona, and you see that Michael set the pace. And what that means is, guys, he had the utmost incredible 100% respect for that locker room and the guys that were wearing a uniform. And that not only was in the Barons' locker room, but it bled over to the visiting team, and they would come into our locker room, and they, again, would engage and try to get their autographs and their pictures and all that, and he never said no the entire time. So it was something where he himself, he didn't know what to expect. You know, you got to be careful with the word pun, the pun air, you know, what kind of air about him did he have? But he set the pace because he tried to be one of the guys. He played ping pong. He played dominoes. He taught the Spanish guys English words and gave them money when they got it right. So any animosity at all, he immediately took that and said, that's not going to happen here. You know, I'm one of you guys. Let's all go out to Hooters. Let's go out to wherever it is. And he was one of the guys. I know, again, that sounds strange, but that's what he wanted to be. And I researched it so much to get back to answering that question. I researched and talked with everybody involved with the White Sox, and they swear to me, everybody I asked said he did not take the place. He did not prevent somebody else from coming up. Okay. There was basically a hole, so to speak, in double A in the outfield. And so he fit right in, but it's not as if there was somebody there waiting to grab that spot. That's what was explained to me.
Well, so Kurt, let's talk about his performance, because I remember thinking, you know, how in the world is this guy going to compete at double A? I'm sitting there at single A and thinking, man, these are really good players. If you make it to double A, you are really, really good. And so he's diving in there. I thought it was a huge achievement for him to hit 202. But that was 1 year, and I know for Michael Jordan, he didn't get into it to try to hit 202 at double A. I think he got into it thinking, I want to help the White Sox, right? So how was it viewed how he was doing during that season?
We all look at it, and that includes his coaching staff, his peers, as an incredible amount of progress that he made. I don't know if there's a guy alive that who had never played a sport before that could compete in what we think, and you play the game, what we think is the hardest thing to do, and that's hit a ball with a bat. And, you know, it's not like guys are lobbing it or playing wiffle ball or anything along those lines. And the 202, you take that and throw that out, because that was basically the start. But he really had a good July and August. He drove in 50 runs. He stole 30 bases. And for those who remember the Hoover Met, and you'll see it on 30 for 30, possibly see it again on The Last Dance, they have a very spacious ballpark. Very, very difficult to hit home runs. And he hit three. So we, the inside group, his manager, Terry Francona, his batting instructor, Mike Barnett, they looked at the amount of progress that he made. In fact, it's. I really wanted to do this interview because the city of Nashville would have seen him. And my forecast is that the very next year, 95, remember, baseball was still in a lockout. But I really am convinced he would have been in Nashville. He would have been yours up there for a couple of months or so, and then got called up to the big leagues. So, again, the average is, it is what it is. You can't fake it. But I think it's misleading because there were quality at-bats, and baseball people know what that's about. There were line drives that he started to hit. And at the end of the day, you can't fake three homers. Stat that just continues to run around my head. Like, I've got guys that have played baseball their entire lives, and they won't hit three home runs in a single year with the Barons. Okay, so now you put that in perspective. He's never played the game, and he hit three home runs.
Yeah, I think that's good perspective. And so, Kurt, that's what I'm really curious of is how the real scouts were seeing what kind of ceiling we're talking about. I saw a clip that just happened to be circulating. It was a clip of him in the Arizona Fall League, and Terry Francona was coaching his team, and he was mic'd up, and he was being basically interviewed while Michael Jordan is up to the plate. And Jordan actually hits one up the gap and hits a triple. But he was really, you could tell he was sincere. He really thought that there was a lot of room that he was going to grow, he was going to develop rapidly. So that's interesting, because I think we have all in our mind played the what-if game. What if we had a summer in Nashville where Michael Jordan was playing for the Sounds?
It would have happened if it wasn't a lockout. I'm very convinced of that. I think Terry has said the same thing. I think White Sox people that were involved with the club, Ron Shuler, I think, has said that along the lines, and others who were in that front office. That was the progress. You know what you had? You had speed, okay? Stole 30 bases. The guy's an incredible athlete. He played good defense, caught the ball, could run in the outfield. So, you know what? You put him in the eighth inning in a game where you need defense or you need a stolen base, and you can do worse. So everyone looked at it as a complete positive. And, again, it's kind of interesting because Nashville, you know, when I got the first phone call from your producer, I'm like, wow, you know, wait till these guys really feel that you're talking to me, but you could have been talking, if baseball wasn't in a lockout, you could have been talking to the Nashville announcer because he would have been there in 95. Okay, so that's the way the progress was taking him in that direction.
Kurt Bloom is with us, the voice of the Birmingham Barons. So when was the moment that you found out that he was going back to basketball?
Well, see, he played the whole season with us.
Yeah.
And so we had to be, like everybody else, listening, watching, whatever. And I stress this again, guys. Remember, there was no social media. Cell phones were probably in a bag back then. It was so different. The times were different. So now there was no Twitter. There was nothing that said, I heard a rumor. You know, he announced it and said two words, I'm back, and that was it. And again, I'm convinced, Kurt Bloom is convinced. That doesn't mean the next guy has to be. But I'm convinced if there wasn't a lockout, he would have saw this thing through. Might not have had those other three championships, or maybe at some point he goes back. But remember what we talked about, mentally fried, physically fairly exhausted as well.
So you mentioned what he was like with the team and being around the guys, and you said teaching English to the Spanish guys.
Mm-hmm.
Can you recall some personal encounters with him and what it was like for you as the announcer?
Yeah, a great question. And of course, that's what everybody wants to know is, you know, my friends, family, and everybody, hey, did you get his autograph? Did you get a jersey? Did you get this, that, and the other? And again, look, you guys are, let me properly say that, y'all are in a big city, okay? So you've got Nashville football players with the Titans, and you got a hockey team now, which is really, you know, one of the most exciting cities for that sport. I was there for a playoff game, and it was just complete madness. Okay, so in our case, it was, you know, it's something that, again, no one dreamt of, no one thought that it could happen. It did, and it happened into a smaller venue, but it takes a lot of people to do that. So that being said, you know, You do everything. He was there for 150 games. You never had at any point late in the season. There was no talk of I'm going back. It was one day grab a newspaper and a headline and it says I'm back, and that was the end of that story. But I will tell you this: I do know for a fact. I have spoken not directly, but indirectly with him and his people. And they have said that it was the greatest summer of his life and the greatest summer of the people around him. Guys, when you have the big cities we talked about, you got to build trust. And that's what the most important thing was for me, is to build that trust factor with him. So my interaction was the basketball game we played in August, the infamous 3-on-3 where I set the world's most talked about screen or pick. And then there was the one-on-one interview that I had in August after all the national people had their opportunity. It was time for me and him to sit down, and it was the only one-on-one that he had given the entire year. The newspaper people that followed him in the NBA, they came down, they got what they wanted, but there was nothing else that happened. But it was he and I, and again, that was what I need. So you ask about interaction, you know, whether it's, I'm going to make this up, Eddie George or Pecorine or something along those lines, you know. You got to build trust before anything else. And that's what my goal was. And again, talking to his people indirectly recently, I think we accomplished that.
Do you still have the tape?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, if I can shamelessly promote KurtBloom.com, the audio of his first hit, his first home run, the interview, the 15-minute interview is on there, plus a stint that I did with Charles Barkley. And again, you know, when you get that close to a guy like that, even if I didn't have tape, it's all in my head. Sometimes it feels like it was yesterday. And it's 26 years ago this year. But, yeah, I got the tape and pulled it out. And remember this, when you say tape, here's another education for some of the younger listeners out there. We were on cassette back then. So I actually had to convert cassette over to over to MP3 and then play it from there.
Well, at least you didn't say it was on reel-to-reel, you know?
Right. That's next. Go cart. Eight-track.
Yeah, the cart.
Now,
the old
Pete,
cart.
If Pete is listening, Pete could tell you about it. I know because he told me once about converting some of his stuff, and I hate to see what kind of material that Pete Weber was using. But, we hauled around these Marantz tape recorders, and that was it. That was how we got things done.
We'll all be holding our breath if Pete Weber ever decides to come out with a book. And
right.
You know.
Oh, no doubt.
I did want to leave you with this, that the ballpark down there, Regions Bank, it's a beautiful ballpark.
Regions Field.
Every time we come down for SEC Media Days when it's in Hoover, we're always checking the schedule to see if the Barons are in town. In fact, I think the last time we went, Chase and I went to a game, we decided just to break away from the pack. We just showed up. We sat about two rows from the
home plate.
From home plate, and, you know,
remember who was playing?
No, that's what I was racing through my head of who they were playing, because I know what organization, because he was in the on deck circle, and I'm sitting there.
He had signed with the White Sox, Justin Morneau.
Yeah, well, nice. You just nice. Let the cat out of the bag. So anyway, this guy comes out of the dugout and he's in the on deck circle, and I'm sitting there and I hadn't looked at the scoreboard, any idea, and he's just warming up. And I look at Chase and I said, who in the world is that guy? Because like I said, we're sitting right there. I was like, that guy is huge. I was like, that guy does not look like a minor leaguer. And sure enough, when he walks up to the plate, they're like, Justin Morneau. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Dude's been in the bigs for a long time. He was on a rehab stint. But that's the beauty of minor league baseball. Yep. Kurt, really appreciate the visit and your perspective to back them. Thanks for doing this. We'll all enjoy episode 7 and 8 this Sunday night, and we'll talk to you down the road. Thanks for doing this.
It was absolutely my pleasure. If I could take just a few more seconds, what I wanted to say is how much I appreciate, first of all, you guys thinking of me as a subject. The second of all, your audience and your listening audience and the people that follow you, they have no idea how difficult a time this is for people in your position. So I salute you for putting these shows on with basically no content. As a play-by-play guy, your job is to call the game that's in front of you. I don't have to worry about who's my guest today. So I just wanted to thank you and to encourage you guys, keep grinding, do what you're doing, and keep entertaining people, because we need you on the air to help us get through these days.
Very nice. Very nice words. Thank you very much, Kurt.
Quite
really
welcome.
Appreciate it. Continue to be safe. Thanks for doing this.
Will do. You too.
Kurt Bloom, who is the voice of the Birmingham Barons, unique perspective there. He's been their longtime voice since the early 90s, who you just heard there in that interview. We will come back and start the final hour of the program with a little Friday trivia. That's next.